I
pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, for roll call, Mark will not be here tonight. Mark Spohr, that is. And I want to welcome everybody that's here. Thank you for coming. We appreciate you coming. And next on the agenda is citizen input. And that's for citizens that would like to address the council on council items. Just raise your hand, I acknowledge you, and come up to the mic and say your name and address when you come to the mic, and then you can address the council for 5 minutes. Roger, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council people. I've got my, I just started to write my speech, but I didn't even have time to do that, so.
Excuse me, Roger, could you give us your name and address for the record?
My name is Roger Teamy, and my address is, 22717 Bench Road, West Bench Road.
Thank you.
Is the mic okay? Can you hear me? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then I started my second speech, so you can see this is not going to be too long. First thing I had down on this little one, though, was to say what a good job the council's doing. You're all my friends.
Well, thank you.
And we like to be your friends as well. You know, in our mission statement, we have, and be a good neighbor to the people we serve. And we've always hoped that as a corporate citizen that we've been able to do that. And I just want to be here this evening to reinforce that commitment. We know the city is going through some changes, and we realize that we're getting more and more traffic, and realize that there's going to be a change in that intersection, and we realize that in doing that, you've got to route things differently. And we also realize it'll increase the traffic going right by our store. You know, it's really not a surprise. If you'll notice, we've done quite a little work, and we were able to take advantage of some dirt to help build more parking area and things like that. In our position, what we want to do is we've got a concentrated effort to minimize the traffic back and forth across that street. So we'll be moving, by this fall, you'll all see the results that the number of trips that we make back and forth across that street will be dropped at least 50% what we're doing of what we normally do in our normal business actions, but hopefully even more than that. Now that's kind of part of it. The other part is as we increase that traffic out there, we have to have enforced speed limits. And I would suggest that the 25 mile an hour speed limit that you have here at the intersection of Broadway and Main, that 25 mile an hour speed limit runs out there about 3 or 4 or 5 blocks and then goes to 35. I would be very disappointed if we have a 35 mile an hour speed limit on that first 2 or 3 blocks. It needs to be 25 miles an hour, not 35. Another thing that we really need to do is make sure that you're in communication with the sheriff's department, because they use that road sometimes on emergencies, but they forget to turn on a siren. And when you've got traffic going through there that you're anticipating is going to be running at a reasonable speed and have someone coming through there at 45, 50, 60 miles an hour, it can be a real surprise to a guy on a forklift. So we'd ask you to address those two issues. Another one is dust. We're going to be moving more and more trucks over there where they come down past Evergreen and turn and go down. I'm not sure what the name of that road is. But I'm telling you, we've lived with that dust coming off of that road for a long time, and it's time to change it. That road needs to be paved. Now, I'm not sure the structure to pave it. I know you've got a big plan already in place, and you're going to wait for federal funding or something to do it. Well, I'm just here to tell you that we don't have time to wait. We need to have it done before harvest this fall. The trucks are going to be running up and down there on a regular basis now, since they are not allowed to park, and I'm not here to discuss that at all, because we know, you know, that things are changing, and we're willing to do that. Give us some help on getting that dust control on that road. Now, if you had the plan in place, you know, we're not here just asking for a handout, and I'm just speaking for myself. If we know what the specs are on that roadway, we would take a look at trying to put something in with some private money, maybe co-opt with the city, if the city can help us some, to those specs. If that's way too expensive, then we've got to figure out another way. But I'm just here to tell you that with the kind of equipment that we've got setting out there, and those big dust rolls come over that, if that was private land, you would not allow it. You would not allow private land to sit there and blow off against the neighbor that way. So I feel that you've got a little dog in the hunt here. But I'm not saying that we're not willing to ride that horse with you. But I really would like to encourage you to take a look at seeing what we can do to control that dust on that road, and then those speed limits. Speed limits probably first. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Is there any other, Sean?
Sean Bates, 1156 East Juniper Street. Still, at this time, it seems as if the traffic signal caution light north and southbound on Broadway is pretty quick. You've got half a block. If you're traveling at the speed limit, you've got half a block of reaction time. I'd like to see that increase to one full block distance from the time that the signal changes at speed right there at the intersection of Cedar Street. I'd like it to be from there up to the signal light. So there's about a second and a half more response time. This is something that was questioned and addressed at a couple of council meetings over the last couple months, and this new razzle-dazzle rocket science signal machine still isn't quite tweaked in yet, so just wanted to keep it in front of you. Thanks.
Thank you. I believe this week they're adding a second to it?
Yes, they are adding a second. As soon as they make their loop around and they hit Othello, it will be increased.
Yeah, they will be adding another second to that yellow light and stuff for the change this week. But thanks for bringing that up. Anybody else needs to address the council? Okay, well then I'll close the citizen input time. Do I hear a motion for the approval of the agenda?
So moved.
Charles first, Dan second. Okay, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same. Okay, do I hear a motion for the consent agenda?
I'll make this motion.
Sure. Ken Johnson first, Ken Kaler second. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same. All right, that passes. Thank you. Now we'll go to current business 4.1, Bank of America presentation. Mike?
I'm passing out some material here that is provided by U.S. Trust, which is an arm of Bank of America. And then I want to I'm going to introduce Terry Meyer. Terry took over our portfolio, I think it was around 14 years, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Okay, we'll give you a few days. We'll give you a few days. And I've really enjoyed working with Terry. As you can see by her bio, she has a lot of experience. And the thing I really enjoy about Terry is she's very responsive to our needs and things we've talked about. She acts on it really quickly, and so it's just been a real pleasure working with her. And she's here tonight to discuss our investment portfolio and kind of where it's going and what the economy looks like and the impact on our portfolio. And so I'm just going to introduce Terry Meyer to the council.
Thank you, Mike. Well, I have these lovely speeches here I can put aside. Well, I think each of you has your book in front of you. And first off, I'll lead off by saying that we sort of, at the beginning of the year, decided that we wanted to make sure that everyone understood, clients and prospects alike, that we're going by the name of U.S. Trust these days, even though Bank of America does own us, just to have a distinguishing presence in the market. We have a huge tradition with U.S. Trust in money management that goes back to 176 years, so it's something we're really proud of. So U.S. Trust is what we call ourselves these days. I also want to introduce Brett Barton, who's down here in the front, who's sitting alongside me. Brett is the client manager on the account, and we're from two different offices, actually. Brett's from the Boise office, and I'm from the Portland office, but we're new blood, if you will, in the organization. I joined in December, and Brett, when did you come back into the fold?
About 5 years ago.
Okay, so some changes on the account, but hopefully the level of service will not be any different from what you've detected in the past, and that we're always available to you, either one of us. It doesn't have to just necessarily funnel through Mike. In my opinion, if you have questions, never hesitate to call or email, and that goes for Brett as well. And Brett's really the lifeblood to everything that's outside of the actual functioning and the portfolio management with the account. So any bank-oriented questions and that sort of thing, Brett would be able to help with. So on the first page here, just going over the economic outlook, which these days is no minimal task. I think the financial press has had its share of, I would say, brouhaha in the past several months, and the crescendo has probably been as loud as ever, literally in the last few weeks and even following this weekend. When you look at what's going on in the national landscape on the debt ceiling issue, which has to be resolved in just next week, that would be next Tuesday, August 2nd is the deadline. And rather than go through each of these elements here, which I'll touch upon briefly, I just want to say that in terms of fixed income instruments, which this portfolio is entirely made up of, you know, the bond market, if you will, there is nothing probably more important than making certain that the federal government has their house in order. And there's two rating agencies out there that have been there forever, literally, since I've been in this business. And I don't know the exact date, but they were thinking 40, 50 years that Moody's and S&P has been in the business of rating bonds. And the U.S. Treasury bonds and notes have always been the highest quality instrument that you could invest in, not only in the United States, but really in the globe. And so it's no understatement to say that having this deficit situation not be adequately addressed when there's only a week to go, literally, that is putting a lot of stress in the financial markets here and abroad. That is not to say that we at U.S. Trust and our thought leadership here think that we have a horrible situation in our hands. We think that a lot of this has been political positioning, unfortunately. We're definitely in a situation that needs to be resolved, not just now, but for the longer term, to get our budget in order. And it's becoming a brinksmanship type of exercise, because I think everyone involved in the Senate and Congress, and including the President, realize it has to get resolved. Even if there was some unusual circumstance where there'd be one missed payment on interest payments for government treasuries, we think it would be very quickly resolved. So that would be technical default, if you will, just having one missed payment, even if it were a day late. It wouldn't be a good thing. It wouldn't be a good thing for the financial markets at all. It wouldn't even be good for the stock market. But we think it's like 0 to 5% chance that that's likely to happen here. But the two different agencies, Moody's being one, and then Standard & Poor's being the other rating agency, they have a difference of opinion about whether or not the AAA credit rating will be kept with the Treasuries, given the type of scenario that will be worked out. And Moody's is saying, hey, if you don't have a default event, then we'll keep this AAA. We'll keep an eye on the situation and hope that in earnest that the federal government does put together a game plan over the next 5 and 10 years out in the future where the budget will in fact be balanced. So they're giving a more, I would say, lenient type of attitude towards the situation and more faith, if you will, that our government will work properly and responsibly. Standard & Poor's is being a little bit more fierce with their bat, I would say, on this subject. A lot of it's because of what's happened with the credit crisis in the last several years. They have been criticized terribly for being slow in downgrading municipals in particular. So it's sort of a reaction or maybe an overreaction to what they didn't quite do right in the recent past. And they've said if there's a default, there's a mispayment even by a day, we will downgrade the status of the Treasury to junk bonds, which is just extraordinarily radical. If there is a resolution, all interest payments would be paid in full, but it's a temporary solution that gets us to November 2012 through the next presidential election. That's not good enough for Standard & Poor's rating agency to keep the AAA rating. They would take it down one notch to a AA rating. Now, we think that that could happen, that scenario, the last scenario I outlined, maybe 60, 65% chance that Standard & Poor's, that one of the agencies will downgrade to a AA, and the other agency, the Moody's, will stay at a AAA rating. So you'd have a split rating. You probably have a reaction in the bond market where rates will go up, as, you know, we call this a knee-jerk reaction. Part of what you're seeing in Europe with the Greek crisis, where rates there have been extraordinary, they've been like in the 30%+ range. You know, that's what happens when there's stress, is rates will tend to go up in the absence of anything else happening. We think that that would be a very temporary move and that eventually rates would come back down. I mean, maybe in the matter of a week, maybe in the matter of a month or so. But we do think this will be resolved within the next week to a palatable situation. We're not panicking, we're not dictating any changes in our portfolios, but it's definitely keeping people awake at night, and there's a lot of debate, and you'll just continue to see this probably hammering on your television and radio in the next week. So I think the best outcome, we put a 30% probability on, that would be what we call the grand deal scenario, which would be we get a $4 trillion game plan to cut the deficit over a 10-year period of time. That's what Obama's been trying to do, and I don't want to put any politics in this room, but just in simple terms, that's what the Democrats have been reaching for, and it just isn't happening because that game plan includes increases in taxes, and that's just not been acceptable to the Republicans. So that's sort of it in a nutshell. With this portfolio, I feel like we'll get into the guts of the portfolio here, but I feel like we've been pretty conservatively situated with lots of treasuries and agency, federal government related bond paper, if you will, and we should be in good stead with the shorter maturities that we have in the portfolio. In terms of the growth, both domestically and in the global environment, we've been in a distinct soft patch that you've probably heard in the financial press. And some of that is related to what went on with the tsunami and the quake in Japan, circumventing supplies. A lot of that has affected the auto industry here domestically and kept production lines in a muted mode because of certain components. And that translated also into the consumer realizing that they were going to buy a car now, they weren't going to get the best deal because of the supply being, you know, much smaller. And you also have unemployment statistics that have dropped, you know, come up just a little bit in the last several months. And so all of this has conspired. Some of the unemployment is explained, by the way, by the curtailment in the auto industry because of those components being, you know, in short supply or not coming back from the Far East into our market. So it's kind of snowballed into what we call a soft patch, but still growth, still on a recovery trend and track. And we think at U.S. Trust, and I don't think we're unusual at this at all. I mean, consensus thought is that the second half of this year, you will see a return to 3% domestic gross domestic product, and that in the globe, you're looking at more like 4% plus, maybe 5% all over. So we're still in a really, I would say, more of a settled and stable portion of our recovery with a little bit of soft patch most recently. Nothing like the scare we had a year ago in the springtime that then catapulted us into the federal government doing the quantitative easing program for a second round, if you will. That's all done, and we feel like we're in good stead. If you look at the inflation environment, we have a little bit of core inflation that has come into our domestic economy, trending about a 2% rate. And that is actually, I know a lot of people look at that and they can say that's bad, but for investors, a little bit of inflation, and for consumers too, especially as wage earners and maybe farmers where you appreciate some inflation in your crops, a little bit of inflation is a healthy thing in the economy. One of the things that our government tried to avoid in the last several years, we had the credit crisis, was a deflationary scenario. And that's when your financial assets get it going into a tailspin where you won't see appreciation. So we avoided that, and we now have a little bit of inflation, and we at U.S. Trust think that's a pretty healthy thing. So we feel good about the direction that we're headed with both inflation and growth, especially in the second half of this year. Unemployment has been extremely stubborn, and we think we're going to be seeing an 8% unemployment in 2012, probably by the end of 2012, which would be a really nice change of events from the 9.2% that we're seeing across the nation right now. And I would say that what we're most optimistic about when we look at the economic picture is just private sector profits. They've been extremely strong and steady. We're about a third of the way through the earnings season for the S&P 500 Fortune companies, and about 70% of them have exceeded expectations and reiterated, or for the most part, not everyone certainly, for the most part, revised guidance upward. And a lot of that's because they're getting a benefit from being positioned with the emerging markets, where consumers are starting to really come into their own and demanding more, I'd say, American-oriented brands. And the multinationals are well positioned to address that demand. And they also do get a benefit from a weaker dollar when they repatriate earnings back over the seas. So that's in the nutshell. I'd say we're still pretty positive. And if you looked at our perspective on different asset classes, we're most bullish on equities. However, this portfolio is fixed income. And if you turn to page 2, you'll see that we have a depiction of the Treasury yield curve. And it is steep right now. And that is a good portender, if you will, of the aspirations for continued growth and recovery in the economy. That's a healthy yield curve. We do expect that the next move in the curve will be a flattening move. And we think that what will happen is that the shorter term rates will come up first, maybe a whole 2% as we look out over the next 18 months to 2 years. And again, that would be a reaction to a healthy economy. If you look at the curve, the blue, the navy blue line here, you'll see we've had rates come down slightly since the beginning of the year, and the kind of the, I would say, taupey gold color is where we were at the beginning of the year. But it's happened mostly beyond the 5-year maturity mark of that move. And that's been as a result of this soft patch we've been in, where the rates have come down again. What that means for the value of bonds, though, when rates come down, bonds go up. So that's benefited the portfolio, but it mostly benefited the portfolio in the second quarter. There was very little price action or appreciation in the first quarter of this year. And then certainly, as you look at compared to full year ago, which is the red line here, rates have gone up. This next chart is just a comparison to municipal bonds. And one of the reasons, and that's on page 3, one of the reasons I included it here is because we do have allowance for having municipal bonds in this portfolio, but we haven't utilized that to date, at least not in the year-to-date and one-year time frame as I've seen it. And that's because there really is no advantage from a pure yield standpoint unless the portfolio is taxable. And so really this applies more to individuals and how you compare and contrast rates with different tax rates. And that's what the yellow and the red line is, if you tax affected the Treasury. But you can see here, with the municipals being the green line and the blue line, they're really very, very close to each other in yield. Generally speaking, the Treasuries are always going to be just a little bit higher. And then the next page, page 5, I've given a brief synopsis and a picture, if you will, for the quarter. The second quarter ended in June. That's where these bar charts are, with the bright red and the orange in the far right of the page, and then the year to date. And you can see quite clearly, if you look at the different segments of the bond market, that the movement mostly happened in the second quarter. The last 3 months of that period is where the bonds really moved up as rates were moving down in this soft patch signal in the economy. And we attach ourselves mostly to this Merrill Lynch. If you look right straight in the middle of the list, you have the ML means Merrill Lynch, 1 to 3 year treasury, and then the ML Merrill Lynch 3 to 5 year treasury benchmarks. And you can see then the 1 to 3 year, the very ultra short maturities, there was an appreciation of 0.8%. That includes interest as well. And for the full 6 months, only up 0.9. A little bit longer maturities in that 3 and 5 year space, up 2.6% in the quarter, and then the same 2.6% in the 6 months. If you look at the bottom of the page, you can see that the differences, if you will, with U.S. Treasury being on the left, the 2.4 and 2.3%, that's again the quarter and in the 6 months, but the corporate master was a little bit greater, performed a little bit more, and that's because of the higher yields on that paper or those bonds, 3.3% for the 6 months, and then the Merrill Lynch High Yield Master, we'll call that the junk bond index, if you will, up 4.9% in 6 months, just to compare and contrast the movements in the market the year to date. And this page here, one is a characterization of your portfolio, all fixed income, and the valuation being $4.66 million plus. And we valued this on July 20 last week. And the total cost profile is $4.534 million. So we have a nice embedded gain in the portfolio altogether. Cash is roughly 5.5% of the portfolio. And estimated annual income as it stands is $135,000 plus at this period in time. And the current yield on the total portfolio is 2.91% if you attach yourself to that $135,000 estimated annual income. You'll notice there's no yield showing or reflected for the cash balances, which are in a money market fund, and that's just the state of the union right now. To have your money as safe as can be, money market funds are like just barely paying anything, and it rounds out to 0% to have absolute safety and security and no price movement in the principal. Rates are really low. They were really low at the beginning of the year. It came up a little bit, but now we're just historically at an extremely low point on rates. So there really, honestly, is no place but to go up, if you will, on rates, given the backdrop and the scenario that we see where things continue to be in a recovery mode, maybe a slower recovery mode, but recovery mode nonetheless. If you look at page, and you're in tab 2, page 2 now, and you have a pie chart here, you'll see the blue in the pie chart is pooled investments, that's mutual fund investments for the most part for this portfolio. and that makes up slightly over $2.2 million, 50% of the portfolio. U.S. agency bonds are in the red, over $1.1 million, making up 25% of the portfolio, and U.S. government bonds over $1 million, making up almost 25% of the portfolio. And then this is a good description page, page three, following that. You have the quality rating reflected for the individual securities in the bar chart on the left. That's real close to 50% of the investments, and then the pooled investments being the other 50%. And you have a maturity profile outlined here as well, where your 0 to 2 year maturities are 38% of the investment individual investments. So this maturity schedule here does not relate to the pooled investments, just to be clear. 2 to 4 year maturities are 31%, and then the other third, or 31%, is in the 4 to 6 year maturity range. The average coupon in this portfolio is 2.7%. The current yield is the 2.58%. Duration, that's another measure, for maturity. It's always somewhat less than absolute maturity. It's 2.69, and that would be expressed in years. And average maturity, 2.81. But just to give you a flavor for what duration is all about, it's a nice mathematical, easy handle on the portfolio and its risk exposure. So think of any 1% change in interest rates, and this duration figure, this 2.69, you would multiply by that 1% change, and it would result in a 2.7% change in the valuation of your bonds. So if the maturity duration in a measure was 6 years, you had a 1% change, you'd have a 6% change in your principal amount. So that's what duration means. It helps you understand the risk exposure of the portfolio. And the next page is just repetitive, actually, from one other page on the pooled investments versus the singular investments in the AA paper. And this is a breakdown of absolute maturities in the portfolio, spanning from maturities less than a year in the 2011 bar all the way out to a 2017 or very close to a 5.5 year maturity in that 2017 bond. And the rest here is the individual portfolio holdings, starting on page 6, beginning with the money market fund reserves, moving to the individual pooled investments, the ultra short-term bond fund, the Columbia government series, the Barclays TIP fund, the PIMCO total return, and then from there, a listing of the agency and treasury holdings. The very last page here, not the definitions, but page 9, you can see is a performance investment summary. And you can see the YTD year-to-date column, which is after the percentage allocation. The total portfolio is the very bottom performance number in dark blue, 2.76% appreciation in the 6 months, ended June 30. We don't have performance through July 20 like the rest of the portfolio was marked to. We just have performance through June 30. And you can see the comparison here to the Merrill Lynch 1 to 3 year treasury, which is the light blue above. That benchmark was up 0.86%. And you can see T-bills or a cash measure, 0.09%. If you look out to the 6 months is the same as year to date, excuse me. Out of the 12 months, the 1 year, the portfolio appreciated 4.08% as compared to the Merrill Lynch 1 to 3 year treasury of 1.34%. And then if you go all the way to the right, you see since inception, which was November 2005, and this is an annualized figure, 4.71% return on the portfolio compared to the benchmark at 3.96% on the Merrill Lynch index. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from council? I know it's making more money than my savings account is. That's nice to see. So, well, There's no questions. Thank you very much, Terry, for coming.
All right. I'll be here for a remainder of the discussion.
Well, I think it was a good choice for the city to to go with. Actually, today it's U.S. Trust. Back then it was U.S. Bank. And just as an to give you a good example, the Washington State Investment Pool is paying like 0.02% on our investments. A few years ago, when interest wasn't all that high, at what we thought 5% wasn't that high, we would be getting $12,000 a month in interest on our state pool investments, and now we're getting like $680. So that's a huge difference. So the return that Terry talked about at even 2.91 is quite a bit larger than what we're getting from the state pool. The reason we keep money in the state pool, by the way, is liquidity. We can move it around easily and call in the morning and have it in our bank account by noon and things like that. So a lot of people will ask me, how come we don't move more of that money into the U.S. Trust? And that's pretty much the reason. And the picture of that is that our property taxes come in twice a year, and we get a big hit in usually May, and then we get another one in late October and early November. And sometimes our cash flow can kind of dry up in between that, so we have access to the state pool to cover those times. So if anybody had that question in mind, I thought I'd answer it ahead of time. I want to thank Terry, and I don't know, Mayor, if you want to move on to the second item on the agenda.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike. Consideration of financial investment policy waiver.
Okay, I want to
pass this out, and I'm going to read it.
When we developed this agenda item, Terry had discovered that we had two items in our portfolio that didn't meet the criteria of our investment policy, and we looked into it, and I talked with the state auditor, and I didn't get an answer on that until today. So we thought if we could get counsel to actually give us a waiver on our investment policy to keep these investments, because if we change, we'll lose between $59,000 and $61,000 a year in revenue in earnings. And so we thought, well, it'd be nice if we could hang on to them until maturity. I think the state auditor has changed our mind on that, and I'll just read this out loud. To answer your question below, the city would receive an audit finding during the years in which public monies were left in unallowable investments. Our office, if we felt necessary, could ask the state attorney general's office to get involved and review the city's actions. And I want to paint a little picture of that for you. An audit finding is the second worst thing you can get in an audit. That's serious stuff. In other words, you're not abiding by the rules and the laws and et cetera. And so it's bad enough to get that 1 year. If they came back the second year and that same thing was still in place and they gave you another audit finding, then they call the Attorney General's office and say that the city of Othello is rebelling, so to speak, and then we would be subject to a lot of investigation and so on. So the thing is, I just wanted to say tonight, we are not going to ask for a motion for a waiver. I think it's very clear why we are not going to ask for that. And I would just like to, maybe Terry would like to just speak to this just for a little bit, because she offered to fix this about a week or 10 days ago, and she could do it in a day or two, okay? And so I'll just let her speak to this just to give you some confidence in what she plans on doing with that.
No problem. One of the great things about this portfolio, even though we did notice some things that were somewhat out of policy. I wouldn't say radically out of policy, but out of policy, is that everything's extraordinarily liquid. So if I enter a trade, as long as it's before the market hours, I can lock in a price within the day, and depending on which pooled, and we're talking about the pooled investments here, on which vehicle it is, some of them I can have them settle in one day, others will settle within 3 days. But the price realization I can get the same day. The decision is made, so right now it's going to be tomorrow. And the really good news is that all of those pooled vehicles, except for one, are up substantially. One is flat. So there'll be some nice gains that will be realized. And when the money's put to work at somewhat lower interest rates, at least it's being put to work at a higher principal level than we would have had otherwise. So it's not as if the liquidation is going to be damaging to the absolute principal value of those investments, which is a good thing. They're extremely liquid.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation, Chair.
So I just want to give you confidence that we're going to move in the right direction and it'll happen right away. There is a gain associated with that. So this year isn't going to be impacted so adversely because of the earnings on it, but in the future, the earnings will be much lower because we are in some very non-risky investments, safe stuff, I guess, call it. So, are there any questions? Is there anything I can offer?
Doesn't look like it, Mike.
Okay. I want to thank Terry and Brett for coming tonight, and for Terry's watch care over our investment portfolio. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Terry, for noticing that, so we know about it. Okay. Resolution accepting the Public Works Trust Fund loan for SR24 infrastructure. Eamon?
Can we put that on there?
Oh, I got
that.
Yeah,
okay.
Let me summarize and get us all up to speed. At a previous council meeting, Larry Julius of Grain Osborne asked council for confirmation of the resolution that would accept the Public Works Trust Fund loan for SR24. There are some questions as to what is it, what's the scope of work, and what did it encompass, where did we go, what did we do? In other words, what do we get for our $600,000 that we spent on engineering? Well, the first PowerPoint is basically all the statistics relative to the project, the location, the demographics of the area, the project benefits, and the project components, as well as the proposed infrastructure improvements with cost estimates. And this was the important part, is where did the cost add up? Now, recall at the last meeting, none of this was available, so the council and the mayor asked that we set a time aside that week for the council to come in and review the project. I think 4 council members ended up coming in that Thursday, and Larry Julius was here and went through all of the scope of the project with all of the drawings and engineers and draft. The second slide. Do you know how to do that, David? Second slide. Thank you. This slide shows the entire SR24 industrial area project. Basically, it starts at Harvest Fresh on the north end and then proceeds down south through all the industrial area to basically Bench Road. That's the overall project. Now, there are elements of that project. Next one, Debbie. Thank you. There was a sanitary sewer element of the project, as you know. Most of the south end of the city is not sewered. In fact, none of it is. The yellow lines represent, again, north is to the left on this slide, where Harvest Fresh is, moving to the right through the industrial area and all the different roads with the sewer lines on it, all the way south to Bench Road. That's the sanitary sewer. The next one is the water distribution system. Basically the same scheme of things relative to the design of the project, water and sewer lines will be put in together along the project. Again, the goal was to provide water, sewer, storm drainage, and roads to the south end. So all of this has been designed. The next slide, please. The street reconstruction, groundwater drainage, and storm sewer system, as you can see, basically parallels the water and sewer diagrams, with the exception of the storm drainage, which takes everything from the east to the west and then to our drainage pond by Highway 26. So that's basically the project in overall and then broken down. I think there's one more. Nope. So in conclusion, that's the entire project, all the data relative to the information on the project, what was gathered, how it was spent, and then the project broken down, water, sewer, stormwater, streets. So with that, we would ask that the council entertain a motion to accept by resolution the SR 24 infrastructure loan project.
Any questions or comments from council? Okay.
I think after reviewing this and whatnot, because we wasn't sure what we were seeing or whatever, and I think they've done an excellent job about this after we went through it and explained some of this to us and what's involved in it. And, I think overall, I think it was a good project, so I'm in favor of it.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate you coming in and looking at it, and Gina, and I can't remember who else came in. I think Mark was there also.
Okay, do I hear a motion to approve the resolution closing the PWTF contract number PR09-951-051?
I so move.
Second. Second. Taylor first. Okay, Mark Snyder seconded. Any further comments or questions? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed the same? Okay, thank you, Amy. That passes.
Now we'll look for construction money so we can put it into place.
Okay, electronic vehicle infrastructure ordinance. Daryl?
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. For the record, Daryl Piercy, city planner. Before you for consideration is an ordinance which adopts the electric vehicle infrastructure section of our code. You may recall in a study session not too long ago that we reviewed this and identified that this is now a requirement under state law that local jurisdictions adopt elements in their code which do not prohibit the installation of the infrastructure necessary to accommodate electric vehicles. The ordinance before you for consideration would meet the requirements under state law. Again, just a reminder that there's no requirement that any infrastructure be installed, merely the allowance of infrastructure to be installed, say on a private lot or at a business. There's no obligation of the city to install any of this infrastructure. So by adopting this ordinance, your code would then allow for the installation of the electric vehicle infrastructure, and it's identified by infrastructure type and allowed in certain zones depending on the type of infrastructure that's being proposed. Be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions? Okay, do I hear a motion to move to adopt the electric vehicle ordinance?
I'll move.
Second. Dan first. Okay, Gina second. Any comments or questions? Further? No? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed the same? Okay, thank you, Daryl. That passes then. Okay, residential parking ordinance. Daryl.
Well, Mayor and Council, I'm very pleased to be back before you again this evening to discuss residential parking issues. In all seriousness. Before you for consideration is an ordinance which is very similar to the one that was brought back to you, I believe, two meetings ago, in either late June or early July. And following that meeting, there was some comment by council that you would like to see some identification of where there could be exemptions to this requirement of establishing a residential parking area and how that might look and what types of uses might be allowed for the exemption and which types might not, and then to try to create some time limit to how those exemptions could be utilized. So in looking at our code and looking at codes of other cities, it was apparent that it would be very difficult from an enforcement standpoint to simply say you can park outside of your designated parking areas in residential lots for a period of 24 hours in any week, for instance. I've seen that in some codes. And in speaking with those cities that have those kinds of arrangements, it's almost impossible to enforce. So in looking at it further, there appears to be some opportunity to at least generally identify those types of uses that might need to be an exemption to allow you to park off of the designated areas. And those would be such things as landscaping and landscaping installation and maintenance. If your house is going to be re-roofed, that re-roofing truck might need to park off onto your lawn area, you know, directly below your roof as they tear off the shingles and throw them into the truck. And those are the kinds of examples that we see in other codes, and we've attempted to include in this code to give an indication of those times when you could, in fact, legally park off of that designated parking area and then establish some time frame, in this case 12 hours and then 24-hour period. So during a normal work day, the roofers could come in, strip the roof, pull the truck off, and if they needed to come back the next day, they could. What it does continue to prohibit is those day-to-day activities that you might have, you know, dropping off your groceries or dropping someone at the front door, so you wouldn't go over and park your car in the grass so you could perform those tasks. Those would be accomplished in those designated parking areas that the code would require you to establish. So we believe that this is meeting the intent of some of the concerns that were expressed and provides at least examples of those exceptions that could be allowed and still provide some opportunity for code enforcement where there's just clearly blatant violations of the code being undertaken where there's no unusual or unique activity taking place. So we offer this for your consideration. We hope it hits the mark this evening, but if there's any questions or concern, we'd be happy to respond to those.
Anybody? Dan?
The therapy clean surface, it seems to me we're not trying to punish anybody or make things hard for them, but if I understand that if this thing goes in within 5 days, okay, so then you can't park there. But then the 30-foot limit, it seems to me we could work out some kind of a deal where people could get gravel or whatever from the city at whatever the rate happens to be and then pay for it over a period of time in their utility bill. So they don't have to pay for the whole thing all at one time. You can say you have to have it, and if you're going to park on the street, then you have to pay for it all at one time. So I'm not sure that Daryl didn't suggest this a year ago. I think we were talking about this, something like that. And maybe whether the city would have to look and see if they could, if that would be legal to do, or, you know, it almost kind of like an LID, but the problem with an LID, everybody has to sign it, and then takes forever. But this would be an individual person to come to the city and say, okay, we want to put in the 30 feet. And the city would get a load of gravel up there and then they could pay for it over time. It seems like to me that's reasonable for anybody that wants to do that. We need to take a look at that so that we're not saying eventually we come along and say, well, you have 30-foot parking place and you have to park there and you have to get it fixed right away. I don't think that's fair either. So I'd like to see you take a look at that possibility of doing that. If we have to look into budget to fund it somehow, we're coming up on a funding thing, so maybe that would be something we need to look at.
Catherine, do you have a comment on that? Is that legal for the city to do?
Well, I mean, there's some options that you can look into, but at this point, I think really the question for the council is, what does it want to do with its South Street parking? You know, you've had this issue come up several times before you, and you've considered lots of different options. You're going to have residents that are unhappy when you take some sort of enforcement on parking. This is a particularly popular subject in all of my cities, generates a lot of disagreement as to how to approach the off-street parking, because the reality is there are many places in town that did not have the benefit of the kind of infrastructure that other areas were required to have. And that's normally something that we like to put the onus of on the developer, not the individual homeowner. But the reality is, when you buy property that comes substandard, if you will, there's a certain price to having to bring it up to standard. And that's not something necessarily that the city needs to be responsible for. You know, what you're asking for, Dan, is a mechanism to alleviate the burden on the homeowner, but that would be at the expense of the city. And I think the policy question from council really is that the role that you see the city fulfilling, is kind of fixing those past mistakes to make it more equitable for all of your homeowners. If that's a policy decision of the council, then we can probably look at mechanisms to get there. But I think, first of all, you have to decide if that's the role that you want the city to play in this particular issue. And it's not just off-street parking. You're going to get this that comes up with other issues where you've got differences throughout your city based on how that portion of town was developed and what infrastructure came up. You know, if someone were to come in and develop now, they would have to have that off-street parking. There's no question about that. And the developers would roll that into the cost of the development, where the homeowner would roll that into the cost of building their home. But you're essentially trying to fix past mistakes. And the question I think you need to ask yourself from a policy standpoint is that what you want the council to pursue? You know, Daryl and I can come up with creative solutions if that's the direction you want us to go. It's your money. It's up to the council.
Well, I just,
you're trying to give it up.
They come along. Originally, we had said something about, you know, you have to have, if you're going to have off-street parking, you have to put it in a place. And so, consequently, you're forced to put it in if you're going to have off-street parking. And I'm looking for is some way to alleviate the pain for a citizen when it comes up and say, okay, you got to go down and buy two loads of gravel and get it put in here. I know the guys can kind of spread it with their truck a little bit, and then you have to rake it out. But to pay, what, $300 or whatever, I don't know what the cost is of a load of gravel, and then to pay it, you know, right off, it became a tick-tick loan, I guess, through the city of 1% or whatever it happened to be, and pay it off over a year. It seemed like a reasonable thing. If we can do that legally, then I don't see anything wrong with putting it in. But it's just a suggestion.
Well, one of the things I might suggest is that most of these homes have a parking space that generally meets the requirements that are outlined by ordinance. They're just choosing not to use them in those cases where we have, you know, pretty severe use of the front yards and the grass areas. And they're not parking on gravel now, but they do have paved or gravel parking areas that are already identified on the site. I might suggest that we, if this were to be adopted, that we could monitor those areas or those individuals that weren't able to come into compliance with this. And there's going to be a transition in implementing this and working with the property owners. And identify the extent of the issue and the problem. You know, are there three homeowners that need to put in gravel, or are there 25? We don't know that. And so maybe in 90 days come back to council and say, now that we've implemented this, we've identified 12, as an example, 12 residential sites that they simply cannot seem to find the means to bring their location in compliance, and is there a program you'd like to establish to help these folks out? But what we don't know now is even what the extent of that issue might be. I suggest that the compliance rate is going to be substantially high, because in most situations, the infrastructure is already there. They're just choosing not to use it, and we have no way to enforce them to use it. And that's really the intent of this ordinance, is to provide a tool where we can bring people off the lawns and into their designated driveways that already exist.
And I would just offer two comments to follow up on that. First of all, number one, Dan, that the city can't get into the business of extending loans for these kinds of activities. But number two, in terms of the alleviating the burden on the homeowners, traditionally, what I've seen our cities do is exactly what Daryl's talking about in two instances, or in two respects. Number one, they mitigate the impact of enforcing the ordinance through the enforcement process itself. In other words, normally they'll give an extended period of time to come into compliance as a opposed to running out tomorrow and hammering people to get it done in 10 days. You know, they'll look at, depending on how many this affects, a reasonable period of time to accommodate people who need to get their affairs in order, their financing in order. And your enforcement officer is going to be able to get an idea of the severity of the violations. You know, if you've got three cars parked on the lawn and you've got plenty of area to put in a parking space, they're probably not going to be quite as lenient as they would be with the person who only has one car and no place to park. You just have to gravel it. But the other area where we compromise is, you know, most of our cities, when they adopt an ordinance like this, always allow them to put in a less onerous surface, like, or as far as cost goes, like gravel. I mean, really, you can't get much more lenient than that. You can't let them park on dirt. You can't let them park on landscaping. So they've got to park on some sort of an approved surface. Well, short of asphalt and concrete, which are very expensive, but, you know, the most feasible economically is gravel. And so we've accommodated them within the ordinance itself by imposing the least onerous burden, financially and practically speaking. And so I think really it gets back down to the policy decision for the council is, do you want to enforce this kind of a parking restriction? You know, drive down your streets and take a look at this, you know, the residences and decide for yourself. Do you want those cars on an approved parking service, or do you want them out of the street or on the landscape? It does make a difference when people drive through your town, as far as aesthetics.
Daryl, first I'm going to thank you for your patience, because I think this is our ninth time possibly having this up here in front of us. We went back and forth on it quite a few times. And from the beginning, I have took the stance with the Planning Commission. And I still believe that we should stand behind the Planning Commission and their original recommendation. And that's no improvements, use our existing code. Looking at the one that you did, that you have proposed here, I do like the thought of the gravel for existing. But instead of, a lot of my concern is, I haven't seen the big problem around town, driving around town. I haven't seen a great big problem of people parking on their lawns and making it a permanent parking spot. Yes, you do see the occasional person parking up there, like you stay here to drop off their groceries or drop off a person. I know we had a couple of elderly people said that they parked close to their front door because it was easier for them to get in and out of their car, especially in the winter. They had less area to walk with their handicaps. Looking at this, the only way I could see going forward with it would be to not pass it on the existing ones now, but as the property sold. So they would have to bring it up to compliance in some of our, because basically we're dealing with the existing residents, our new developments and stuff, but with our existing. And as our existing residents sold, as that resident sold, then they could be brought up to compliance. And then the homeowner or the buying person would know what they were looking at or what they were getting into to bring everything up to compliance for that property. And it's less of a burden on the existing citizens.
Well, this isn't forcing, if you don't have a driveway, it's not forcing you to put one in, correct?
No, it just gives you the parameters that if you want a driveway, this is what it would look like. These are the maximum widths. It needs to be somewhat perpendicular to the house and, you know, to the street. But it doesn't require you to have a driveway. If you're happy parking out in front of your house on the street and you like your entire front yard to be lawn, we're not going to make you tear out that lawn and put in 30 feet of parking area now. There's no requirement that you have.
To me, this seems pretty reasonable. I mean, if people want to park in their front yard and they can throw some gravel down there and they'll have a, you know, a driveway as long as it fits this, the 30 feet of asphalt, concrete, or gravel.
I think it all boils down to how it's interpreted and enforced, because each incident is going to be different. Every home is different. Every driveway is different. And the way you look at it, it boils down to is what's that person that's enforcing its opinion that day versus the structure. I mean, this was brought to council way before I was ever on council, probably 35 times when Eleanor was on council, and probably still back to the same situation. It all boils down to it was brought up because it's a handful of homes that are pinpointed. You know, and Kenny's right. A person buys a home and then you're gonna change the rules. It's like playing Monopoly and changing the rules. Guess what? Then it's shame on you. You can't keep changing the rules. People are not gonna kind of agree with you as we go down the street. And I mean, this is as good as I've seen. I'm not gonna lie, Daryl. This is, I mean, that's as close as I think you're gonna ever come to making people kind of happy. But ultimately, it's, if they couldn't afford to park, build a driveway, and they parked on their lawn, what makes you think they're gonna put any gravel in to park on it? I mean, it all boils down to money. I mean, so you can sit there and fine people to death. But ultimately, it's for a handful of people in this town. It's pinpointed. So I'm with Ken. You can't enforce it on the guys that have a mortgage. They've had a mortgage for 5, 10, 15 years or better, and now you're going to change the rules on them. I mean, ordinances are great. I mean, they're good for what they're used for. But you can't keep tacking them on. Eventually, you can't enforce them all. Every now and then, we got to fight crime and do some other things too. I mean, but Daryl, I mean, great job. Seriously.
Ken?
My thought, I don't know, I'm kicking this around and toying with it too, but I think the main object of this whole thing is that 30-foot driveway. If they get over that, they shouldn't have a car parked there, period. I don't know if it's a big issue whether you got a surface or concrete, asphalt, or gravel, but I think they should stay in those bounds, the boundary of that 30 feet. And I know we went through this before, but we've got a situation right now that's, the building is still under permit, but they've got two 30-foot driveways in their yard, and nothing's been done about it. And that's the thing we've got to stop. I don't think it's a big issue. Maybe you do park on the lawn a little bit, but in this country, probably 90% of the time, you're not going to tear it up. You probably have to waddle by, but that's about all that's going to happen. Wintertime, you're probably not going to park there anyway. But if you do change this one, you're going to have to go back and change 61.010, because it definitely states concrete or asphalt.
And that's for all new construction or new development, yes.
Right. And so you're going to have to do something there a little bit too.
Well, I would not stand before you and recommend that new development is allowed to have gravel driveways. I think that would be a big step backwards for the direction the city's heading. So, but I think you can also have disparity between new construction and existing neighborhoods. And the gravel site, the gravel on the existing neighborhoods is one to try to create less of a burden if you were to impose this.
Any other comments? So am I hearing from the council that you like what you see and you want, I'm not quite sure here, but it remains the same until they sell the home? Is that what we're saying? Is that how you want to adjust it?
You know, I like the one that, like I said, this is probably the best one I have seen. You know, I've been, like I said, I took the stance of, no, I like what the Planning Commission, but I do like this, but if we could have it added as to bring the property up to compliance as the properties are sold.
You know, generally that's a really easy thing to do for commercial properties because you track change of ownership in commercial properties through business license and through the site plan review process. But we don't have any comparable mechanism in the residential side to track home sales or home ownership. And I think it would actually be an extremely difficult and probably pretty expensive process to do that. And then to somehow cloud titles for all these properties in the city so that when the title changed hands, you then had this requirement that kicked in. So I honestly believe that the process of accomplishing that in a residential zone would be